Today is Thanksgiving. Normally when I read my own stuff, I often preface before I start reading with a couple of observations. So I want to say we're doing Thanksgiving, but we're going to look at the Thanksgiving themes in some ways by looking at the opposite of Thanksgiving, which is dealing with a bitterness and what you do with that in your own life. And also, just before we get into the text, I just want to frame, perhaps very briefly, just so you can maybe have that rattling around in the backside. We often ask, and it's one of those fundamental questions, you know, like, why do good things happen to bad people? This is one of these things, you know, why did God allow this to happen? How could a good God allow this happen to this kind of thing to happen? So we often frame the problem of evil in that question, but this early story of Genesis basically asks the same question, but it frames it in the completely opposite way. In a sense, if I'm a good person, why am I not being blessed like the other guy? So it sort of flips the question on its head. And so we get into it, people of God, and very often we don't pay enough attention to the stories of Genesis. In many ways, I think, you know, we're a tradition that values theology and theological thinking. And unfortunately, I think that as a result, we have, without really meaning to, devalued stories and the value of storytelling. And the truth of it is that the vast majority of Scripture comes to us in the form of stories and storytelling, and that's basically how Jesus communicated to his crowds. And in a lot of ways, there's more power in stories than there is in theology, in part because stories oftentimes don't hit you over the head with the meanings, and I almost feel bad that we're going to have to explain the whole story here this morning and hit you over the head with it, but that's kind of what you do here in preaching. We especially don't pay proper attention, I think, to the early stories of Genesis. Especially being sort of post-Enlightenment, too many of us look at the first chapters of Genesis through the battles of science and origins and so forth. And we get sidetracked when we read Genesis into arguments of, you know, creation science, long day, short day creationism. And in part because of that, we often really miss the point of why these stories were told in the first place and why they're retold and told again and why they were collected and preserved, why they are so important. These early stories of Genesis function, the academic term would be, you know, foundation stories. What that means is that a foundation story is not so much meant to tell us what happened in the past per se. It's an old story about things that happened in the past, so in some sense they do tell us about the past. But a foundation story is meant to tell us about the world that we live in today, the world as we see it and encounter it. So even the story of like Genesis 1, where God created the world, tells us about the world that we live in today. And the same thing that in that sense that it was made by God. He spoke it into being. And that's an important foundational idea and principle. We've talked about this before in the last few weeks. The same thing with the story of Cain and Abel. It's a foundational story. And what these stories do is they set out for us the major problems and dynamics that we see operating all around us all the time for us as humans. They establish the framework and architecture of the world in which we live, not through, you know, academic talking and so forth, but through storytelling. So they set this framework up by telling stories. The ancients thought about history very differently than we do today. We see history as, you know, a series of events. Events happen sort of one after the another, and potentially they have meaning. And the job of the historian is maybe to provide some meaning for these events, their causes, why one thing happened in sequence to the other, and why certain events and certain things lead to other events. And but the ancients didn't really look at the world historically the way that we do. Instead, what they saw was a series of what we would call archetypes or patterns that would continually reoccur in the world. And the stories give us examples of these archetypes or patterns, in a sense that you would try to emulate them or avoid them, or you would see them at play around you. And we often see this at work in the way that the Old Testament story is told. Sometimes at the choice of word choice. So if you know Hebrew, you'll be telling a story, say, of David or whatever, and your mind will think to yourself, like, oh, I've heard that word before. It jars you. It's not the normal word. The consonants are the same. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's right. And you something would go off in your mind. You think, oh, he's another Joseph. And that would give you then the framework. We're seeing this story play out again in a new event. And so it reinforces. It's like, oh, he's another Moses. Or he's another David. The Gospel of Matthew is especially, this is one of the tools that the author of the Gospel of Matthew uses to help us understand who Jesus is. Jesus becomes the embodiment of all of these figures and stories. He is the embodiment of Israel in its totality. He is David, he is Moses, he is the prophets. So Jesus becomes the embodiment of all of these Old Testament stories walking among us. So when we meditate on a story like Cain and Abel, we have to see this as a presentation of archetypes or examples. And what we have here then is, because this is an archetype type story, what the authors are saying to us is that here is a fundamental dynamic, a fundamental human dynamic that you are going to see around you all the time playing out again and again and again. And because this story comes to us right after the fall, a good case could be made that this is perhaps, in a post-fall world, one of, if not the, fundamental human dynamics. So we're seeing a very core human dynamic playing out here in this story. Something profound is going on here that we need to pay attention to for our own good. We ignore the story of Cain and Abel at our peril. And not only that, but I think in our time right now, the day and age that we live in, this story is especially important for this moment in our culture. So what's happening here with this little short episode of Cain and Abel? Well, it kind of gets off to a boring start. You know, they're out of the garden. Adam and Eve have two sons. Abel, the one son, he keeps flocks. The other son, Cain, he grows crops. They're both farmers of different sort. And then we're told that Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering. We're also told that Abel brought some of the fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock as an offering. Then we're told that God looked with favor on Abel and his offering, and he did not look with favor on Cain's offering. Now, one of the things that people have done, and it's unfortunate, and I think in part because we don't want to face the truth of what's going on here, is oftentimes we characterize the story, you know, well, Cain's offering, he must have been a bad guy, and that's why God didn't look like his offering. Abel was a good guy, and that's why God liked his offering. And then we can sort of dismiss it, because I'm basically a good guy, so I'm not really Cain. But if you're looking at the text in the Hebrew, especially, there's not much there to really make a solid case. And it's not obvious in the original language that Abel somehow brought a better offering than Cain. They both brought offerings. And the text really doesn't make an overt judgment about the offerings themselves. We often project God's response to Cain back to his offering, say, oh, this must be why God is reacting to Cain. But the text itself really doesn't tell you ahead as we're going through the story why God accepted one offer and rejected the other. And I think if we don't make too much of that, the story unfolds with much more power. Okay? The why of why the offerings were accepted or rejected really isn't drawn out for us. It's never explained. And in fact, again, the lesson here is much more powerful if we don't focus on the offerings or the people or the why of the refusal. We live in a world where we have been driven out of the garden. Part of the reality of that world is that bad things happen. This is one of these big questions. Why do bad things happen? Well, we live in this post-garden world. God seems to bless one person, but doesn't seem to be blessing someone else. And sometimes this stuff doesn't make sense. I think of myself as a good person, so why does all this bad stuff happen to me? Or I don't seem to be any better or worse than the guy down the street, and everything just seems to come easy for him. Why is it that if everything I have to scrape, work, beg, steal for it, and everything just seems to fall into the lap of Buddy down the street? It doesn't seem fair. In this kind of world, the key question, when it feels like we don't have the favor of God, and this is the important point of this text and this story, is not that stuff is happening or not happening to you, is your offering being received or not received, but the question is, how will you respond? We live in a world where we've been driven out of the garden. Now, how do you respond to this world? Cain is ticked off that his offering is refused. And a good case could be made that he's probably perfectly justified in his anger. God meets with Cain and says to him, why are you angry, Cain? Why is your face downcast? It seems like God maybe is testing Cain by rejecting his offering. It seems like he sees in Cain one of the fundamental workings of sin. God says to him, okay, Cain, your offering, your sacrifice was rejected. Now what? How are you going to respond? See, we often expect the world to fall at our feet. Especially if we're smart or we're talented or we think of ourselves as, good and decent people, that somehow we deserve to be blessed, to have good things happen to us. And though we get bitter and angry when the world doesn't beat a path to our doorway to tell us how great we are. A few weeks ago, we talked about, one of these fundamentals again, too, of following Christ, of, take up your cross and follow me, of carrying burdens, of making sacrifices. We talked about this as fundamental to the faith journey, fundamental to being a man, that sort of thing. But what do you do when you're making sacrifices and it seems like they're not being rewarded? When they don't work out the way you've expected. You've given, you've sacrificed, you've carried burdens. And it seems like the whole way you're struggling uphill, like God is against you. To me, this has often been one of the stories of my life, right? I mean, I know that I can look back and I can see things I regret, I've done. But a lot of times I've looked around and I thought, I'm smart, I'm capable, But it seemed like all my life there was like, God was passing out the instruction manual to everybody else but me. There's always that guy that seemed to be, bigger, he's got broader shoulders, he runs faster, they seem to say the right things, all the girls seem to like him, he gets grades and I don't really see him studying or whatever. He's got a fantastic job, he's got a nice house, drives a great car, everything seems socially whatever, just everything he touches just turns to gold. And I'm thinking to myself, like, what has he got that I haven't got? You know, like, again, did he pass out the manual? You know, and he's even got nice skin and people like him. And it's like, I can't even hate him. But, you know, it's just like, you know, like, what's wrong here? Something doesn't seem out of sync. You know, everything just seems to fall into his lap or her lap. So what do you do when your life seems to be one struggle after another? When it seems like the world, like God, is against you? I mean, it really is easy for us to kind of brood on our catastrophes, of the things that are going wrong, or the things that aren't happening right in our lives. And we let these feelings sink on us and poison us. I mean, how many people do you know that seem to go out of their way to make everyone else around them bitter and miserable? Everything that could be seen as good, they find a way to spoil it with criticism. There's nothing so fun and joyful that you cannot find fault with it. And they resent everyone and everything. Even when they give, they're taking it away with the other hand. And it really is easy to let bitterness get the better of us. You know, next thing you know, you're out in the backfield sticking a knife into your successful, God likes his sacrifice better than mine, brother. You know, that's how it happens. That's life. I mean, how many of us are snipping behind somebody's back, right? Because they're popular or whatever. You know, we're out there. We got the knife in the back. We're trying to ruin their lives because their life just seems a little bit better than ours, and we're just resentful and we're bitter and we're chattering behind them. Yeah, that knife is in there. Maybe not physically, but oh boy, if we could, we would. We live in a society, too, that drowns in bitterness and resentment. And this bitterness, jealousy, and resentment, it gets cleansed and prettied up by clothing it in the language of, you know, social justice. You know, people railing, this is just one example, but people, you know, they're railing against the 1%. You know, it's funny, you often look at these people, you know, out protesting and stuff. A lot of them come from wealthy, upper middle class families. And, you know, we live in a society, almost any other area of history, we have so much prosperity. By the standards of history, even the poorest among us live by like kings and queens. And yet for most of us, we're angry that some other guy is richer than we are. The world did not fall at my feet the way I expected, and now I'm angry and bitter. And somebody has more than I do, and I'm bitter and angry. Somebody has it easier than I do now, and I'm bitter and I'm angry. And that seems to characterize the spirit of our age. So God is saying to us, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? Sin is crouching at the door and it desires to master you, but you must master it. So you live in this post-Garden of Eden world. There's the reality. Sin is crouching at the door and it desires to master you, but you must master it. See, in the flip side, opposite to this basic dynamics is what we would call the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, gentleness, kindness, goodness, self-control. That's your flip side opposite to this reality, this world of Cain. This is where the passage in Galatians is so important, and these are not the only ones. You know, the first thing to do is perhaps not compare yourselves to other people. You know, stop looking out and saying, well, you know, I'm better or worse. He's got it better than I do. That was in part Cain's fault. His offering didn't go up. Right away, he's looking at the smoke rising in his brother Abel's offering. You know, next thing you know, he's out in the back 40 sticking a knife in his brother's back. And that's kind of the way it goes. Don't make yourself proud. Don't let yourself become miserable by comparing yourself to other people. And Galatians, interesting, it uses that same language, you know, that we've had in past weeks. Carry your own burden. Don't be trying to look to somebody else's burden and carry or don't carry that. Carry your own burden. Stop comparing yourself to other people. Live your own life. Don't try to live somebody else's life. And like Paul says in Philippians, don't look around and try to keep a scorecard. We often do that. We often say to ourselves, well, I may not be perfect, but, you know, I'm better than that guy. We often carry around a resume of things that we feel makes us good people. It can be a resume of worldly success. It can be a resume of spiritual success, like Paul is detailing. Paul says that none of it matters. All of these resume things that I can use to bolster my ego, none of it matters to God. You know, so don't compare yourself. Don't try to bolster your resume. It doesn't matter. God is also saying something else to Cain, too. He says, Cain, he says, you need to face yourself and see yourself honestly. So first thing is stop comparing yourself to your brother, Cain. And then look inside and see yourself honestly. Cain, the problem is with you. It's in your heart and it's in your mind. There is a seed of bitterness and anger and sin. And sin is crouching around looking to take advantage of that to ruin your life and the lives of everyone around you. Don't blame me, Cain. The problem is with you. You need to be honest with yourself and deal with yourself. And one of the fundamental sacrifices, we put it into that language of carrying burdens and making sacrifices. One of the fundamental sacrifices that we need to make is to sacrifice the lies that we tell to ourselves. And oftentimes we do this to protect ourselves, to create a sense of who we are and where our life is at. And we create a fog, a mask of lies about who we are and where we're at spiritually and what's going on inside of us. And one of the first things that needs to die, to be sacrificed, if we're going to take this journey of faith, is that fog of lies has to be sacrificed so we can see the truth about ourselves. Like Cain, you know, Cain's, and that's what God was pointing out. That's what I think the reason perhaps why God didn't do his thing is like, because if Cain's offering went up, Cain would never deal with himself. So God was forcing Cain to deal with himself, to grapple with who he was and what was going on around him. Sin is crouching at the door. It wants to have you and take advantage of you. You got to see that, Cain. Be honest with yourself. Tell yourself the truth. We often tell ourselves, you know, well, how great life could have been if everyone else could just see how deserving we are or you know, whatever. Or on the other hand, we tell lies about, you know, how much we've done and accomplished and how much we should have had or whatever. Or on the other hand, we tell lies about how lousy and worthless we are, how we don't deserve anything and can't accomplish anything. The first step to embracing the grace of God is to begin to see the truth about who you are. I mean, how do you see your need for salvation, for God's help in your life, without being honest with yourself? You know, are you honest about your own potential to do evil? How do you see your need for forgiveness? In some ways, you have to do what Cain didn't do. You have to be willing to see the sin that is trying to master you or already has mastered you. So how do you find out about the truth of yourself? Well, it's an interesting thing. I think a lot of times, maybe not every time, but there are some times where we know that we are lying. We are not telling the truth about who we are. We're lying to ourselves, and we're lying to other people about who we are. So the way that you begin to tell the truth is, first of all, by starting to see the lies that you tell about yourself. See, Cain's lie was like, well, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm the same as my brother. And God was saying, no, Cain, there's something going on in there that you need to see. And I'm going to show it to you by rejecting your offer. Cain didn't want to see that. It was just much easier to stick the knife into his brother's back than to look honestly at himself. You may not know what the truth about yourself is. And you may not even see all the lies that you tell yourself. But when you catch yourself in a lie, and you know it's a lie, you need to stop. confess it. Deal with it. Face the truth that the lie is trying to cover up. That's how you grow spiritually. When you catch yourself in a lie, stop it, face it, and look at the truth that that lie is covering up. Sin is there crouching at the door trying to master you. See, this is the essence of the life that Jesus calls to us when the simple message of repent and believe, that's really what this is about. Facing the lies. Recognizing that our life is not where it should be. Acknowledging our need to change. Acknowledging our potential to do evil. What can be changed about me that will make my life better? And that truth about yourself, it can hurt to see it. It can be humbling, humiliating. That's why it's much easier to tell lies and become bitter, resentful, angry, depressed, apathetic, or even vain and prideful. It's much easier to do all of these things than face the truth about ourselves. But if we're ever going to live into a life of grace, it begins by seeing the truth of who we are. Sin crouches around and wants to devour us. So often we let it. You begin not so much with facing the truth, but by recognizing the lie. And when you deal with the lies, the truth will begin to show itself. So you may not have every lie, but you can start. The truth will be painful. And it won't be by accident that you're lying to yourself. The things that you're lying to yourself about are the things that you need to face. And that's where grace begins to work. The world may not be falling at our feet. And there really is no promise from God that it should. But there is one thing that we can count on. And that's part of this biblical story. The main part, actually, of this biblical story. Is that God demonstrated in the midst of all of this, you know, fog of the lies, the brokenness, things that don't go right, the offering, sacrifice that doesn't get received, the blessings that don't come to us, the bad things that happen to us. In the middle of all of this, this post-Eden world, there's one thing that we can count on. And this really is the heart, in many ways, of the message of Jesus Christ. God demonstrated once and for all that He loves us. And He did that by sending His Son, Jesus Christ, to sacrifice Himself on the cross for us. He sacrificed Himself to make our lives better. He carried our burdens to the cross so that we could embrace a new life, the life of the resurrection. We have to remember, though, that when we embrace Christ in faith, what we're embracing is a journey, a path of grace. We may be unable to do for ourselves what Jesus did for us. But this doesn't mean that when we talk about it as a gift, that the new life in Christ is just going to fall into our laps, that we're not just going to start experiencing, you know, blessings just showering on us like a waterfall. We often make the mistake of telling ourselves that if salvation is a gift from God, it's just going to fall into our laps completely, fully formed, and it will require no effort on our part to just live the blessings of God. It doesn't really work that way. Jesus says Himself, take up your cross, follow Me. When we follow Jesus in faith, we are following a path, a journey, a way of life. Now, in biblical language, in wisdom language, when you are on a journey, the end of that journey begins to characterize the present moment that you're in. So if you live the life of destruction, destruction begins and chaos begins to characterize your life. But if you live the path of grace and life, that begins to characterize who you are. So as we walk the path, we begin to embrace, live, experience forgiveness, renewal, resurrection. A big part of that journey is to learn to see the truth of ourselves, the truth of the world. Sin crouches around at your door and it desires to have you, but you must master it. Well, you think, I don't have the strength. Well, that's why God gives you His Spirit, to give you strength for that journey, strength to face the truth, strength to carry the burdens that need to be carried, strength to make the sacrifices that need to be made, strength to live the victory won for us on the cross. I think there's one piece, and we haven't talked really at all about it so far, but I think there's one last little small piece to flip the script on Cain's story, and that is thanksgiving and gratitude. As opposite emotions to the bitterness and resentment that could come if you follow the example of Cain. One of the truths that we need to see is, because of Christ, just how blessed we truly are. We have not only salvation, but we have material abundance that people have never dreamed of in the past. We have health, that we live long, unheard of long lives given history. We live in peace. Again, most of all, Jesus died to redeem our lives so that we have forgiveness. And that when sin does crouch at the door hoping to devour us, because of Jesus Christ and the gift of His Spirit, we can give thanks that we have the strength and the courage, the power from above to stand and fight and win. So the story that calls out to us in this post-garden world, the story of Cain and Abel, the message that the ancients did by telling and retelling and preserving the story for us, is that please, whatever you do in your lives, don't be Cain.